somewhat as my talk will be skirting around the periphery, though, of the main theme. Here's the title. There's probably some impressive looking words here that many of us are not, or many of the people in the room aren't that familiar with. And so because today's talk is going to be a rather long journey over unfamiliar terrain for many, or I expect that it is, I decided to mess around with the arrow of time and start with the end of a previous talk. So this is the last slide of another talk on with a similar theme. And so it's a rather busy looking slide, but the key word for the message is this word up here, collision. And so what I want to convey to you is that there's an interesting confluence of ideas coming together from a variety of different areas. And in particular, the main players are gravity, quantum field theory, or quantum theory, and quantum information. And in part, what's interesting is that quantum information seems to be giving us new tools and new perspective to give us new insights to understand various properties of quantum field theory and general relativity or gravity. And there is a hope that, in fact, this perspective may be a key into unifying general relativity or gravity with quantum theory. So that what we're doing now may be developing a different kind of quantum gravity theory, or what I jokingly there call quantum info gravity. Another part of the story, which I really won't give you much of a flavor for, is that these two players are also an interesting framework that challenges people in quantum information with different kinds of questions that you may not have thought about in other instances. And so it may be that by playing out, or that at the end of this collision, rather than finding a quantum theory of gravity, that we'll get a different perspective on quantum information. We may get a new kind of theory, quantum geoinformation, perhaps. But the other part of the message beyond this interesting confluence is that this is very much a work in progress. And so right now what we're doing is drawing together many different threads from different areas displayed in this busy slide here, and hoping that those threads will come together to form an interesting tapestry. Perhaps this will be the story, or perhaps that will be the story. But it's very much a work in progress at the present time. I also want to keep the technicality in this talk down. And so there'll be very few equations, but there's only one equation that I want you to remember at the end of the talk, and that's this equation. And so this at present looks more like perhaps poetry or an interesting slogan, but hopefully by the end of the talk, you'll have a flavor of why I've put those different elements together in this equation. So it's a long road, and again, I'm not, it's a very broad audience, and so I wanted to start at the very beginning. And back up, one of the entries, or one of the things in my list on the title slide was gravity, and that's really the key, or what I spend most of my time thinking about. And what we were taught a long time ago, almost 100 years ago this year, by this fellow here, is that gravity is really a story about geometry. So first of all, he pointed out that we shouldn't think of space and time as different entities, rather they're linked together in what we now call the space-time. And in fact, that when we think about gravity, this space-time becomes dynamical. And the dynamics of that geometry is really how gravity manifests itself from this modern perspective. Now that was a real shift in paradigm. And it gave rise to, a rich class of new ideas. There were black holes, gravity waves, the whole idea of cosmology took a different perspective. One of the key conceptual ideas here, which again is a theme that I'll return to, is that space-time, rather than just being a stage on which physical phenomena take place, in general relativity, it plays the role both of the stage, but also being an active player or the agent by which the gravitational dynamics are manifest. But the hero at the start of our story today is really these black holes. So black holes, of course, are a region of space-time where the gravitational field or the gravitational curvature, the space-time curvature, is so large that classically nothing can escape. They're very elegant solutions of the geometric equations that Einstein wrote out. They're now also the stars of Hollywood movies. But one of the amazing ideas that came forth over 30 years ago in the early 70s was that black holes weren't really these cold objects or just elegant pieces of geometry. Rather, we could assign an entropy to them. And so this was an idea put forward by Jacob Bekenstein and Stephen Hawking. And it's given by this marvelous formula here. And so this expression, this Bekenstein-Hawking formula, is something that's received a lot of attention in the past 30 years, in part because, as I've illustrated here, by putting all of the constants in, it's a watering hole of many different directions or areas of physics. So we have the geometry here. This is the area of the event horizon, or the area of the surface of no return, this black disk at the center of the picture. But then we've also got the speed of light for special relativity. We've got Boltzmann's constant for thermodynamics or perhaps statistical physics. There's an H-bar for quantum. And last but not least, it's a gravitational object. So we've got Newton's constant here. In particular, in this formula, we see H-bar and G next to each other. And so we might think, or many people have thought, that this formula would be a window into the quantum theory of gravity. And there's been actually remarkable progress, a fair amount of progress in that direction. And in some sense, what I'm going to be talking about is the continuing evolution of those ideas. One of the things that this formula tells us is that when we put all of these constants of nature together, we get a fundamental length scale, the Planck length. So in my favorite combination with that 8 pi, then this formula becomes the area over the Planck length squared with a 2 pi sitting there. And so what we're really doing is we're measuring the area of the event horizon in units of this Planck scale. One of the things to be stressed, however, is that the Planck scale is a really, really small scale. Again, with my choices, it's about 10 to the minus 35 meters, which compares with the shortest distance scales that we probe in the lab, which would be at the LHC, where we're seeing down to scales of 10 to the minus 18. So there's a good 17 orders of magnitude to go. And so this seems well beyond at least current technical abilities on the Earth. Because it's very, very small, that means that the entropies we're talking about here are very, very big. And so the typical example is if we look at the sun, that's a big bag of hot gas, and we get an impressive entropy here with a 10 to the 57. However, if we crush all of the gas in the sun down to a region of space that's of the order of a few kilometers across, it'll collapse to form a black hole. And according to this formula, then the entropy will suddenly jump up by about 20 orders of magnitude. And so even though this was an impressively large number, this small isolated object where all of the gas has disappeared behind the event horizon has a much larger entropy. I've left Boltzmann's constant here in the formula to remind us that, the people who invented entropy were more interested in steam engines, as Jonathan was telling us, than black holes. And in fact, the original discussions of black hole entropy really played out in that context. People were considering processes where things were dropped into the black hole and asking how the black hole would respond. And so there's a story that was developed called black hole thermodynamics, and this is a part of that particular story. But for any conventional thermodynamic system, there's also a statistical mechanical description of that system. And typically, this entropy or an entropy has an interpretation in terms of an uncertainty about the underlying state. And so with the assumption that that still applies here, this formula is telling us something about some collection of microstates in the theory that are describing that object over there. So what's happened is then this beautiful, elegant solution of Einstein's equations, this formula is suggesting that in fact there's some huge complexity that underlies that, at least in the quantum version of the theory. Oh, sorry, I forgot one of my slogans. One of the things is that when we think about thermodynamics or even statistical mechanics, the kinds of entropies that we run into are very different in that typically it's an extensive property of the system, and so it should grow as the volume. Here we're seeing that the entropy of the black hole or this formula, it grows as the area or an area associated with the black hole. And so that remained a puzzle for a long time. But this is where we start to see ideas from quantum information theory, or what's now a part of quantum information theory, come into the story. And so we make a segue to entanglement entropy. And that's something that's well known, I hope, to most of the audience. It's a useful diagnostic that we use as theorists to give a quantitative measure of the entanglement or the correlations between subsystems of our favorite quantum system. Now, in this particular, or in the context of today's talk, the place where I want to apply this diagnostic is in quantum field theory. And so how do we apply the idea of quantum or entanglement entropy there? Well, we start with this picture. In that picture, I've taken a constant time slice or an initial data slice. I take the field configurations on that time slice as being characteristic or characterizing the state space. I need to divide my system into parts. And so we can choose an arbitrary surface here, or what I often call the entangling surface, to divide my time slice into an inside and an outside. I can integrate out the degrees of freedom in the outside region. That leaves me with a density matrix that describes what's left over. Given that density matrix, we just apply the von Neumann formula, trace rho log rho, throw in a minus sign, and in this particular context, that's what we're going to call the entanglement entropy. Now, if I assign this as a homework problem in my field theory course, even before the students set out, I know what the answer is going to be. In fact, the answer is going to be infinity. And so in this particular context, there's a problem. We say that the answer is UV divergent, by which I really mean that the answer is dominated by short-range or short distance correlations in the vicinity of this entangling surface. And so because there are effectively an infinite number of degrees of freedom in my quantum field theory, the answer blows up. And so to make sense of this quantity, I have to regulate the theory. And so I'll do that by introducing a short distance cutoff. You could think of that as a lattice scale if we put the underlying quantum field theory on a lattice. And with a regulator like that, I'll get an answer that looks like this, where I find the ratio of some macroscopic scale, say R, that characterizes my region here over my short distance cutoff to various powers. And the exponents here are controlled by the dimension of the space-time. So if we live, we live in four space-time dimensions, three space, one time, this would be R squared over delta squared. And so this has the appropriate units to be an area. I'm a string theorist. I also like to play around with theories in higher dimensions and lower dimensions. And so in general, I get an R to the appropriate power here. And it's a, if you like, codimension two surface, that's the volume of a codimension two surface. And so typically we still would say that has the units of area. Now, if my students, rather than studying one particular surface, studied many, many different surfaces, in fact, they would find that there's a geometric interpretation of this formula. That rather than just picking some scale here, in fact, I can think of this term as being the area or the volume of the entangling surface over the cutoff to the appropriate power. And with that interpretation, every calculation they make, this coefficient would be the same. Similarly, these other terms, these subleading terms, also have a geometric interpretation that I'm not really going to go into. But you can think of them also as integrals over the entangling surface of some kind of curvatures or extra geometric factors that appear in the integral. Now, that's a very interesting result because here I've got an entropy, and rather than growing like the volume of the region, in fact, I see that the leading term appears to grow as the area of the region that's been enclosed. And so, again, I've, in my narrative, messed up the arrow of time. This is actually where we make the connection to black hole entropy. In fact, it was Raphael Sorkin who set out about 30 years ago now to try and understand the origin of black hole entropy. And so he made this observation that if we calculate the entanglement entropy, we're getting a result that grows like the area, which was characteristic of this formula here in, the Bekenstein-Hawking formula. I've also extended that. This is the form of that formula in arbitrary dimensions. And so again, the Newton's constant here is replaced by the Planck scale to the appropriate power. And Raphael's original suggestion was, well, if this cutoff here was around the Planck scale, which might happen in a theory of quantum gravity, then in fact, this formula looks very much like that formula. This is an idea then that was rediscovered by a number of people, and there was a lot of activity generated around that idea in the 1990s. There were various problems or issues. Some of them were resolved. In particular, one interesting fact is that, well, I told you that these various contributions to the entanglement entropy have an elegant geometric interpretation. In fact, these coefficients depend on the details of how I regulated the problem. So if one of my grad students used a lattice regulator, another grad student used Poly-Villars regulators, or whatever different choices they made, they would, in fact, find that same geometric structure, but they would find different coefficients here. What Lenny Susskind and a student John Uglum suggested or realized is that, in fact, the idea that this is the entire contribution or accounts for the entire black hole entropy can't quite, or that's that story doesn't quite work. But on the other hand, you can think of this as a contribution to the black hole entropy, where this is the contribution of the low energy or the long wavelength fluctuations in the quantum fields around the black hole. And these divergences then, or these contributions, can be thought of as a renormalization of this particular coefficient then, according to the usual rules of quantum field theory. And similarly, these terms here would also represent a renormalization of various other couplings that would appear in a gravitational action. And so there would be other terms that contribute here. And that's a story that we understand now. It's a story developed originally by Bob Wald. But again, this is the leading term, and so that's what I'm going to focus on today. As I say here, or I mentioned before, this was an active topic in the of research in the 90s. And unfortunately, we ran into various technical issues. There were other exciting ideas that came along, and so largely those issues were left unresolved, except for a few brave souls who continue to work in this direction. But this idea that the black hole entropy should be associated with entanglement entropy is something that's seen a revival in recent years, especially there's been sort of in the HEPTH or in the particle physics or string theorists community, a lot of interest in the idea of entanglement entropy, and there have been new perspectives and new insights that have lent credence to this equality here. I can't say that it's a completely understood, but it's a working hypothesis that many of us believe is true. So that would then explain this area appearing in the Bekenstein-Hawking formula. But then let us pause and just remark that this is a remarkable result in that on this side of the equation, I've got something in the geometry of the space-time. On this side of the equation, I've got something that's telling me about microstates of the theory underlying the black hole, the quantum theory underlying the black hole. A question then might be, is this just a formula or is it just a story about black holes? Well, it was very early on realized that this formula is something that could apply to horizons in general. And so in particular, there were examples of cosmological horizons in De Sitter space or observer horizons in ordinary flat space where it made sense or it seemed to make sense to assign this particular amount of entropy to the boundary or a particular boundary of an interesting gravitational space-time. The question or a question that has been posed recently is there more to the story than that? A proposal that was put forth by, the reference I have there is to work by Eugenio Bianchi and myself. Ted Jacobson, I know, has thought in similar directions, is that in fact, this Bekenstein-Hawking formula is actually something that has very broad applicability. And in fact, we don't have to think about black holes, cosmologies, or horizons, but rather we can think about any region of space-time. And that if we're thinking in the context of a quantum theory of gravity, that I should be able to assign this amount of entropy to, or this would be the leading contribution to that particular region of my state in the theory of quantum gravity. This again is a time slice. And so I'm picking out, I'm picking out a boundary that defines a chunk of my space. I'll just leave it at that, but you can ask me more. Well, that's one of the things I was going to complain about. What you see in different calculations is that it's often better to think of this as being associated with a chunk of the space-time rather than a chunk of space. And so in particular, if in your space-time you fix this region or this boundary, this codimension to surface sigma, you can choose arbitrary time slices that run through that particular sigma, and you'll still get the same answer. Yep.
Another way of saying that is to say that you have a two-parameter family with these two surfaces, or in four dimensions, two surfaces by having a space-like and time-like boundary, just like surface and some time-like boundary for them. So couldn't you just use null surfaces in one more dimension instead of more invariant?
I think that's where I would be going in a different talk. That you would there'd be in some sense a null the null surfaces extending out from sigma to the future into the past, and you would build some chunk of the space time in that way. I think that's what you're suggesting. Here I just wanted to say that it's a short paper, but there are a lot of arguments in favor of this particular idea. The warning being that if I needed more than one argument, that means that none of these is really good. I might mention here that I talked about this idea of how in quantum field theory, you can look at the renormalization of G and how that naturally plays into this particular formula. One of the things we showed or argued was that the quantum field theory contribution actually doesn't really rely on there being a black hole or any kind of horizon, and that story would still apply in this particular case. But what I really wanted to turn to was number one in blue here, where we have the magic word holography and another set of magic words, ADS-CFT correspondence. And so, sure. Yeah.
You also say if there will be a black hole with the same area, this formula also.
Yeah.
What's the
difference? No, the point was there was no difference.
This is not tenet. This is true for every part of space.
Yes. Yeah.
And then I put a black hole with the same size, and then this is also true. So how do I distinguish between a black hole and a hole in space when there is no black hole?
With this formula, you don't. The difference in the description was that the black holes that you were studying were stationary black holes, and that the density matrix that went into this formula has a very simple form when I have a killing vector in the background, and so it has a thermodynamic interpretation, and I don't have that in general. So entanglement entropy becomes thermodynamic entropy in the presence of this killing horizon. And so in general, I don't have that thermodynamic interpretation. Holography. Well, this is a familiar picture to many of us, but that's not the holography I'm talking about. Holography, oh dear, my microstates, there they are. This played the premier role in my discussion so far, but it's really only a part of the story where black holes were realized to behave like thermal systems, and they're emitting almost thermal black body radiation if they're sitting in an empty space. This led to various paradoxes, and holography was a suggestion or a proposal to attempt to resolve those paradoxes. And it says, or it proposes, that the horizon not only encodes information about the microstates, as I was emphasizing here, but that in fact the entire dynamics of that object and its interactions with the outside world can be described in terms of what I'll call a dual or an equivalent theory living on that codimension 2 surface. And so, of course, one of the first proponents of that idea is sitting here in the audience. The context in which I'm going to apply it isn't directly to the black holography, is not directly the black holes, but something that emerged from trying to understand the black hole story. And so it goes with this other set of buzzwords, the ADS-CFT correspondence. So what is the ADS-CFT correspondence? I would like to think of it, or I would like you to think of it, as a dictionary. And it's a dictionary between two different kinds of language, but we're really describing a common set of objects or a common set of physical phenomena in this case. So what are the two languages? Well, in one case, there is the language of quantum field theory, but it's not just any quantum field theory. Typically, these are quantum field theories without any intrinsic scales. So there aren't any masses or dimensionful couplings. That's actually something that's harder to do than you might naively expect. But those kinds of quantum field theories are known as conformal field theories, or the initials then CFT. So that's one of the languages we use. The other language is the language of gravity, coupled to a negative cosmological constant. The simplest solution of Einstein's equations in that particular context is anti-de Sitter space, and so that's the ADS of the first part of the correspondence. And so what we're saying here, or what was originally said by Juan Maldacena, is that the physical phenomena that I'm describing here, I can either use this particular language or I can use that particular language, but I'm really talking about the same thing. The reason we have holography here is that the remarkable thing about this duality or this equivalence is that the gravity theory lives in D plus one space-time dimensions, where the quantum field theory, or the boundary theory in some sense, lives in D dimensions, so one less dimension, hence the idea of holography. Now, a priori, that's a topic worth an entire seminar in and of itself. I'm not going to go into all of the details. But there's one element of the dictionary that's perhaps useful to describe. And the immediate question might be, well, if I can get away with talking about this theory with a D-dimensional physical theory, why do I need D plus one dimensions on this side of the dictionary? And the reason is, or a way to understand that, is that I said this is a theory without any intrinsic scales. And so in some sense, if I look at the spectrum of excitations, there's some kind of self-similarity, or I'll see equivalent excitations at all different energy scales. And what the gravity theory is doing is it's organizing those excitations with this extra dimension. So in this picture, there's some kind of space-time here. There's a radius that takes me from the center of the space out to the boundary here. If I'm probing excitations in the bulk geometry out near the boundary, what I'm doing is I'm probing excitations in the boundary theory that are in the UV or at short wavelengths. Similarly, if I probe excitations in the bulk geometry down in the middle of the space, I'm probing low energy or long wavelength excitations in the boundary theory. And so that is a part of the dictionary, that this extra dimension that we've got on this side gets associated with the energy scales in this description of the physical phenomena.
Where does lambda appear in the boundary theory?
Lambda being... okay, so there's a cosmological constant, and so this space has a radius of curvature. In fact, it doesn't appear over here, because what we also saw is this is a theory that had an intrinsic scale, the Planck scale. And so what we may or may not see in the next transparencies, I have a hard time predicting, is that the ratio of those two scales is what controls some of the important properties of the conformal field theory. So for example, if I'm not sure if this is going to help, but if I was looking at a two-dimensional quantum field theory, a key parameter would be the central charge. I would be then talking about a three-dimensional anti-de Sitter space or a three-dimensional theory of gravity, and so the ratio of the ADS scale to the Planck scale is actually what gives us then the central charge of our boundary theory. So it's in that sense that we, well, what appears to be dimensionful over here only really appears on this side in dimensionless ratios or in dimensionless quantities. 5 minutes, excellent, okay. But I saw how well you chaired last time, so that's why I'm holding the hockey stick. I'll try I'll try and go faster. Why do I want to tell this story? Well, there's an interesting idea of entanglement entropy merged together with holography or with the ADS-CFT. Remember that one language, I had this boundary conformal field theory, and so this was a picture that I drew in talking about entanglement entropy in quantum field theory before, and so now this is a picture that could live in that particular theory. What we'd like to do, though, is we'd like to use holography or the ADS-CFT correspondence to translate what is actually a very hard quantum field theory calculation into a simpler geometric or gravitational calculation. And so that's what these folks up here did a number of years ago. And they said that what we should do is we should think about all of the surfaces that hang down into the bulk geometry and connect up to the entangling surface when I draw this picture on the boundary of my ADS space-time or out at infinity. And then what I do is I evaluate the Bekenstein-Hawking formula on each one of those surfaces. I find the surface that minimizes that quantity, and then that minimal value, it turns out, I can associate with the entanglement entropy in the boundary theory for this particular geometry there. And so in another talk, I may have spent a lot of time talking about why this is a reasonable conjecture. But in fact, a couple years ago, some folks in Princeton came up with what seems to be a proof that this formula actually correctly describes the entanglement entropy in the boundary theory. One of the key ideas, though, was here what I'm doing is I'm applying the Bekenstein-Hawking formula, but I'm applying it to surfaces that have nothing to do with horizons or black holes or cosmologies. These can be very complicated, but more or less arbitrary surfaces tied to interesting geometries out in the boundary of my ADS space. One of the things, though, is in this story, I'm mashing together the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy on this side with an entropy on that side, but this was an entropy in the boundary theory. And so this is in the gravity, this is in some other language. Is this really connecting to the story that I was telling you before? And so here I really wanted to assure you that it is natural to think that not only is this an entropy in the boundary theory, it's an entropy in the bulk theory, because that seems to be a natural entropy or a natural consequence of the ADS-CFT dictionary. Remember, I said it was connecting two different languages. In many cases, the words sound very differently. So for example, if I want to talk about a thermal system in the boundary theory, I would talk about a black hole in the gravity theory. But the details, or some of the other words, have a common root. If I talk about the temperature here, I talk about the temperature or the Hawking temperature of the black hole. Well, energy is a familiar concept on both sides, and the entropy here is just the horizon entropy of my black hole in the bulk. So we really are assigning an entropy to these unusual surfaces or in unconventional circumstances in the boundary. And so that's one clear indication that black hole entropy or the Bekenstein-Hawking formula has a broader applicability. Well, okay. A question is, though, you know, is there a similar definition more broadly for arbitrary surfaces in the bulk? And I'll report that, in fact, there's been progress in that direction just in the past couple of years or the past year and a half. But given the time, I'm just going to more or less rush forward. Here's a pretty picture. Here's another equation. And in fact, it's an equation that some folks have, well, this started as a story in geometry in holography, but it's led to an interpretation or of a new quantum information task. And so this really is it's one of these examples where thinking about holography, thinking about black holes is perhaps going to challenge the quantum information folks to think about, quantum information in a different way. So this is part of that equation, or this is part of the story of the equation that I put forward. You know, there's a lot of evidence that entanglement has some kind of close connection with space-time geometry, starting with the Bekenstein-Hawking formula, which is now over 30 years old. And, you know, there are various developments, some of which I brushed over, but it seems to be an idea that has a fairly firm footing. But there's something missing from that equation that I wanted to get to. And there's a story, though, that one can tell there as well. Here, I'm going to move from entanglement entropy to something called relative entropy. So that, I hope, is familiar to many of the folks in the audience. What I'm doing now is I'm comparing, using this formula here, two different states. And so I want to think of rho naught as my reference state, and rho one is going to be a state that's perturbed slightly away from that. So in fact, what I'm going to work with is the vacuum of some favorite quantum field theory, and this is going to be a small excitation of that particular vacuum state. Along the way, I'm going to make use of the idea that, you know, just as a formal manipulation, I can, given a density matrix for my favorite state here, I can define something that's often known as the modular Hamiltonian or the entanglement Hamiltonian, where it's just that this is written as an exponential like that. If I use that notation, there's something that's often called is now, at least in my corner of the archive, called the first law of entanglement entropy. If I, again, I have a reference state and a small excitation of that reference state, the change in the entanglement entropy for my favorite region is equal to the change in this energy or this modular energy. So that looks very much like the first law of thermodynamics. There's no temperature there, but that's because I'm hiding a lot of geometry. There's no temperature in this problem, but there's some interesting geometry hidden in that part of the equation. This generally isn't a very useful equation because if I, you know, write the density matrix in this form, I just get some non-local mess. But a key observation is that, well, in holography, we were interested in conformal field theories. That's a special case. And for other reasons, we were also looking at spherical entangling surfaces. In that particular context, this object has a very simple form where it is an energy. It's just related to the energy density in my particular region. And then there's some interesting geometry here where capital R, of course, is the radius of my sphere. Let's think about how this formula would be realized in holography. So my reference state I'll just think of as empty ADS space, and then here I've perturbed the geometry or my bulk geometry by some excitations given by these pretty colored lines. I told you that entanglement entropy is something that's associated with surfaces that dip way down into the geometry, and so that's probing the bulk down here. This is something to do with an energy. Energy and gravity we typically measure asymptotically, and so there's a formula just relating to asymptotic data that gives me that. And so this is an interesting connection between stuff deep down in the bulk and stuff up here near the boundary. Now the trick is to not apply this to think about a particular sphere, but to apply it to spheres of all different sizes, all different positions, and in all different reference frames. And what you find is that this first law then imposes a restriction on the kind of excitations or how you can deform the geometry down here in the bulk. I can't put whatever bumps and wiggles in the geometry down here that I want, but I can only put a special class. And it turns out that the restriction is that those modifications of the bulk geometry actually have to satisfy the linearized equations. So this stuff here that talks about correlations or entropies in the bulk theory is now telling us something about the dynamics of the space-time geometry down here in the dual language. This again now then reminds us of this theme that I said before, that in GR, space-time is both a stage and an agent for gravitational dynamics. And here in this what this is pointing towards is that in fact entanglement is not just telling us about the geometry of our space-time, but it's also going to be the appropriate lens telling us about the gravitational dynamics. And so that was what was behind this poetic equation here. And at that point, I've run over, and so I'll just put my slogans up and I'll let you read them. And thank you for your attention.
I'm not sure if I understood you right, but are you saying entanglement is a pure form of gravity?
Well, I would have read the equation the other way around. I would have said that in quantum gravity, if I want to build big space times, I need to pick states that have a lot of entanglement in them. Did that make sense?
It's not quite what this equation says, right?
The equation is, again, a piece of poetry that you can interpret however you want. But that was the message that you should have taken away. The guy in front of you can tell you that, I mean, part of the motivation is that in many body physics, there are, the typical kinds of systems that Giffre looks at. There's a huge interesting Hilbert space, but most of the states in the Hilbert space just aren't relevant for the physics that we're interested in. And so I see this as a similar manifestation of that idea, that in the full theory of quantum gravity, there may be a lot of exciting state, there may be a huge Hilbert space, but it's only a very special class of states that at the end of the day we're going to be interested in. And they're characterized by this area, or an area law behavior is sort of a useful diagnostic or an interesting diagnostic to pick out those states. Eric.
Area laws are generally associated to the vacuum states. It's one type of entanglement we have to build. Mm-hmm. Area laws, but there can be other ways.
That's why there was a dot, dot, dot in the equation. Ask a real question. One of the ideas is we call it entanglement entropy because in many situations it's really telling us about quantum correlations, but it's actually a very blunt probe. If you apply it, in a thermal context, there will be an area law term, but there will also be a volume law contribution. In the context I was just talking about, if you allow yourself to go to energy densities or energies at the cutoff scale or perhaps the Planck scale in this context, you can get volume laws. But those states are just so far away from the tip in many body physics, they're so far away from the the states that we see in the lab or probe in experiments, that's not an interesting part of the Hilbert space to visit. Or, and
so your modular Hamiltonian in the CFT case for the spherical regions,
yeah,
it's proportional to the stationary sensor.
Right.
So it doesn't apply in vacuum gravity or
I'm not sure what you're saying.
So this Hamiltonian is then zero for vacuum gravity, right? So does this say that there's some other contribution to the entanglement entropy than just this modular Hamiltonian, or?
So this was in a context where I had two descriptions. One was sort of this, what I'll call a microscopic description, where I understand the quantum field theory degrees of freedom. The other was, you know, my gravitational description of ADS space. And so this was living in the boundary, or in the quantum field theory description. You can apply related formulas. Again, this is, you know, what I was hinting at to Eric, that hidden in this formula is actually the structure of in this particular case it's a conformal killing vector, but there are in other cases where you have a killing vector, you can actually build an object like this. And so there are special cases in general theories, which would include gravity, where formulas somewhat similar to that would apply. But again, they rely on some extra symmetry in the problem. They wouldn't apply in general. Two last questions.
One word I haven't heard to mention was Gauss's law. The idea, because that's the ancient way in which we create a surface for volume.
Right.
If I apply it to gravity, you say, wait a minute, Gauss's law tells me if I integrate the gravitational field on the surface, I get an expression for the total mass inside. The total mass inside in quantum theory happens to be the Hamiltonian. So it means that the Hamiltonian of the inside world can be obtained by just integrating the gravitational field on the surface.
Right.
Now, if you believe somehow in quantum theory, Hamiltonian should say everything there is to be said about the interior. There you have a holography field that you do an integral of the surface, you get the Hamiltonian of the interior. This is a way of saying things that they don't need the word entanglement, although I agree.
In some sense, I think, you know, the spirit of what I was talking about here is very much in that vein, in that, you know, what that equation is telling me in some sense is that there's some kind of boundary integral around a closed region in my gravitational theory, and it says there's a constraint there on that chunk of space-time. What we're doing is, though, we're massaging that formula, on the next transparency, so that we, rather than, you know, talking about a chunk like this, I can specify some information about locally at a point by point. But at the end of, it starts very much in the spirit of what you're talking about, or with the Gauss's law. It's not quite Gauss's law, but it's, you know, you can see that, or actually the whole construction is to phrase it in terms of something here where essentially it's a divergence that gives me this term on this boundary and that term on that boundary. Sorry? If you want to put Gauss's law in quotes, or if you want to... Okay. 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 Oh, so, no, sorry. Folks back there can come and get me in the.
So here we have the derivation of linearized Einstein equation through the Gauss law and the entropy formula. How does the derivation relate with the Tet-Jacobson's law?
Is
it essentially the same?
No, it's it, in fact, it's very, very different as it's presented here. That's it's. I mean, it's something that at the start of the project, we thought we were heading towards sort of a Jacobson-like derivation, but at the end of the day, the way we're presenting it here is very different in that, you know, Ted formulates, Ted's formulation is all very local. He focuses attention on a region and doesn't really worry about where light sheets go or where the boundary goes beyond that region. But here I'm really doing something much, more global in that I build this closed surface that extends all the way out to the boundary. It has the same ingredients, the same language, but it really, at the end of the day, has a very different flavor. It's much more like, this derivation looks much more like Wald's derivation of black hole or the Wald formula than Ted's formulation.
If it is just Gauss's law, or if it is, I think, with the Dunmore cause of boundary unitarity, then why do I need the whole machinery of ADS-CFT to get something to get a kind of log? If it is just boundary unitarity,
it's not the boundary unit. It's not boundary unitarity I learned Gauss's law. It had something to do with electrostatics, but in a broader sense, it may be Gauss's law. But what am I really using? One of the points is that here I have objects and definitions and a constraint that only are, that's something that I'm distilling from this boundary theory. If I didn't have the boundary theory, I wouldn't necessarily know that there's a constraint like that. And so it's relying on, I didn't really tell you this story very clearly, but it's relying on that information about having this dual description or this microscopic theory that then I transform to a geometric constraint on what's happening down here in the gravity theory.
Okay, let's thank the speaker for a wonderful talk.